Hello and welcome to episode 39 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and we use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man. My name is Graham Lee. Now, the topic of today's podcast is whether we are programming in order to program or programming in order to have a program. In other words, are we doing this thing because the activity is fun and we enjoy it, or and it's an end in itself, or is it because we have some goal, some software that we want to produce, you know, some desirable output of the programming activity? Because that changes a lot of the choices we make and a lot of the ways in which we approach the work. You know, if you think about a coding cutter, for example, that is an activity that is done for the activity's sake. You don't necessarily want to produce the output. You want to practice the particular technique that you use in going through that cutter. On the other hand, if you're working at an agency and you need to deliver a product for a client, then it's the product that is desirable. You are programming in order to deliver value to that client, and presumably so that the agency gets paid. And probably a lot of people do both, and that's okay. And plenty of people do one or the other, and that's okay too. You know, there will be tons of like hobbyist programmers out there who don't get paid as programmers, and I have been in that position during my life on a number of occasions. I've also been someone who has worked purely on a sort of 9-to-5 task and like left my hobbies outside or only focused on non-programming interests, and of course mixed the two as well. Now, a particularly fertile ground for crossing these streams, of course, is the free software world, where one person's hobby project may be another person's critical business infrastructure. There may be multiple people working on the Linux kernel who are doing it just for fun, in the words of Linus Torvalds. But then also, like plenty of organisations, businesses, charities, non-profits, universities, whatever they are, who are depending on this thing for their activities to function. And so there's going to be some crossover. And where there is crossover, there is going to be conflicting needs. And so what gets particularly problematic in a lot of contexts, particularly I think in the sort of small business contexts, where maybe the sort of management is a bit freer and the individual engineers in the organization have a much bigger slice of the sort of political clout pie each, and so can each sort of impose their own individual choices with more likelihood of success, is what I call monetizing the hobby, which is where decisions made in support of the fun bit of doing the programming, decisions that support the perpetuation of the activity, are made in the context where what is needed is for the activity to come to an end and for the output to be available. And especially where the decisions made in support of perpetuating the activity are made in claim as if they support producing the output. I think, I'm not entirely convinced by this, but I'll present this aspect of the argument anyway, and then feel welcome to get in touch if you disagree, or if you see some nuance that you want to expand on, or see things in an entirely different way. But I think that what I'm talking about is a reflection of the two aspects of quality that are explored in most of the Robert Persig book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, that some people like the source code and they like constructing beautiful source code and they like learning and applying all of the tricks that their programming language has to offer, or adopting a different programming language and learning and applying its tricks. And some people like the sort of external view of quality. They like the software that they are able to produce. And that is a spectrum that is the sort of the individual values of the programmer, right? You can be someone who values doing a good job and creating a good product, and or someone who values creating code and, you know, and working on programming and spending the time performing the activity. And you can, you know, absolutely balance both of these things, but so, you know, it is very likely that an individual will have a preference one way or the other. I certainly feel at the moment like my preference is more towards sort of creating the product, that, you know, creating the end goal, helping people achieve what it is that they want to achieve using software. And I have been in the past more inclined towards like the sort of enjoyment of the, you know, the craft or the activity for its own sake. But this sort of monetizing the hobby thing is where these two come into conflict. And the reason that I'm only talking about monetizing the hobby form of conflict is that that is the one where an individual's interests get in the way of the goals of like an entire organization or an entire collective of people, you know, however they're structured, where the needs of the few are put in preference to the needs of the many. Because, you know, if there's the other way around, like, you know, if you're a hobbyist and an organization tells you to like shut up with your hobby ideas and just like, you know, spit out the Java they need to get their tasks done, like, there are many coping strategies for that, including going and doing your hobby in your spare time, or like getting another job where you get to work on those things. You know, it's whether we like it or not, it is the way that work works. You do the work that's expected, and if what they expect isn't what you want, then, you know, you either suck it up or you don't. Like, we can argue whether capitalism is a good idea, and, you know, probably have some fairly long discussions on that, but that basically is the way that these things work. If you have agreed to do a thing that an organization wants, and what that requires is for you to put like your particular individual interest in how the thing is done on hold and like hold your nose and get on with it, that's probably what you're going to want to do. And the problem comes when that priority is inverted and you put on hold what everybody else needs to happen in order to get what you want out of the programming project. So an example of this is, you know, of monetizing the hobby is in trying to get all of the fancy like syntax edge cases and posh features of your language into a project so that you can demonstrate how, like, you know, how great these features are and, you know, your commands of the language. I'm actually in favor of the fancy language features when, you know, when I'm having fun, when I'm working on sort of hobbies or on educational tasks. Like, I did a conference talk called By Your Command. I'll try and find it and put it in the show notes. I know I've definitely got a blog like describing its content. I'm not sure whether there was a video. It includes my cover of the Police song Message on the Runtime. And like, you know, this was me saying, like, here's all of these features of Objective-C that we're not really using. What are they and what are they useful for? And, like, you know, I had a lot of fun creating that, and I didn't, like, use all of these features in a single work project, but I definitely connected them to applications. So, for example, message forwarding. Loads of people write Objective-C code without ever using message forwarding, and the same goes for, you know, Ruby and JavaScript and Java and C Sharp and, like, you know, other languages that support message forwarding. And, you know, many people know how to use, like, the forwarding functions in Objective-C or method missing in Ruby or, like, reflection in Java or what, you know, whatever, like, features there are, and choose not to most of the time. And sometimes it is, like the best way to get the task done, and so you do reach into it, but you typically do it as a last resort because you know that this thing is more complex or more abstract, you know, makes it harder to sort of understand what's going on. So yeah, like, you know, definitely sort of learn all of these things because you know, because it's fun or because someone may have used it in a project. But in practice, and particularly where these features require sort of specialist knowledge to understand, you know, if you're reaching for the needs a degree that included category theory in order to like realize why this piece of code is written the way it is, then you're probably excluding a lot of people, not from like, you know, some intellectual pastime, but from the workplace, because you're saying like you can't have a job here unless you understand this thing that I understand, even though it's entirely unnecessary in order to write an application. And you know, the judgment call is not an easy one to make. You have to balance, like, you know, the expressiveness, comprehensibility, you know, sort of terseness, verbosity of the code, which are things that we typically don't have good objective measures for, because like objective metrics for ability to interpret some symbols is a, like, you know, is a losing proposition at the best of times. If you look at the, you know, sort of written language, like natural language readability scores like Flesch Kincaid, the domain in which those are actually applicable is incredibly small, and it is usually a bad idea to try and tweak your writing to sort of score highly on this metric unless you're writing in a context where it makes a lot of sense. And you know, you certainly don't want to adapt Flesch Kincaid to a non-natural language, to a constructed language like a programming language. So you know, you've got all this stuff that's all very subjective about expressiveness and comprehensibility. You've got speed to a working solution, of course, but then also speed from the solution that we once thought was working and now realized isn't, to a corrected solution. So like maintenance of that working solution. At the time you're going to spend training or onboarding developers, you know, potentially including like multiple months or years down the line. You may have moved on. How is this bunch of people who now own and have adopted this code that you created, which was absolutely the cleverest thing you could do, going to carry on using it? Now, one pro tip I have, if you really decide, and like this is a pro tip for those cases where you're already more or less on board with me and you're kind of going, okay, I do want to use this feature here because it is going to help me implement this thing quickly, but I understand what you were saying, Graham, about it being complex, and I want to sort of have my cake and eat it, and I want to get to a position where I can use this feature safe in the knowledge that I'm not you know, giving the shaft to a load of other people who are going to have to deal with my fallout. What you can do is write tests that are agnostic to the existence of the fantasy feature. So test the things that are around this, like, you know, test the method that contains fantasy feature at the method interface level, using non-fantasy features, using straightforward assemble act assert tests. And then if somebody else comes along, they have a choice of like trying to understand your code or throwing it away and writing something else that implements the tests. You know, you've at least given them a number of options there, which is better than just like writing a bunch of code with the most advanced use of the programming language that you can come up with and leaving every other poor sucker to deal with it. A second example is introducing a CV friendly or hobby friendly programming language to you know, to a team or to a workplace or to a project where the outcome of the project is more important than the pastime and your enjoyment of it. And this is one I think should just like be outlawed. Now, I'm going to go on to say that it's quite a complex call to make, as the first one was. But you know, I think like basically there are around 20, maybe two dozen very popular programming languages that it is easy to find people who can like work with them and program in, that are super deployable to like, you know, to anywhere that a customer is likely or user is likely to want to operate this software, and that there's no real reason not to choose those for most workaday projects. Now, if your entire like team and leadership are in support of like trying this new thing out because it's fun and morale is low, and so we could all do with a bit of a pep, or because have decided that we are trying to hire the kinds of people who set fire to everything by rewriting it every few months, and this is a great way to like, you know, put something on our engineering blog that shows that we are that kind of company, or you know, for whatever reason, you might be able to get your entire team on side. And that means that it's still probably a bad idea to do, but at least it's one that you individually will survive, and the team will probably survive. Don't forget, like, a running theme through the last few like episodes of the podcast, and you know, through like blogs I've been writing, and like generally my idea of why software engineering is in the state it is in, is that there's so much money in software for the most part that you can get away with some really bad decisions and still have a functioning organization and functioning business at the end. So you know, you've got your 25 million quid of Series A, and you can write a product that is like completely pointless, and as long as like some metrics go up, as long as you get some sign-ups or you get some you know, some subscriptions, you will get to your Series B round, or you will carry on until you run out of Series A round, but you've got a 3-year stint on your CV, and so you know, nobody minds in the grand scheme of things. The trade-offs with changing language or introducing a new language are similar to the trade-offs of like introducing fancy features from the existing language, except that hiring and retention become bigger parts of the puzzle. Like, let's, in fact, what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to open my browser, have a quick look at the Tiobi index, and see what is somewhere down the bottom, such that it would probably be a popular one that people would want to adopt, but not necessarily one that you could then find other people who did. So like we've got Rust and Julia, which both have about like 0.5 to 0.6% of a search engine market share, and you know, Kotlin or Lisp. Even Lisp is a great one at like at number 34 on the Tiobi index. So yes, absolutely, you could do that. And I'm sorry, I'm just like reading further down, and I see where was I? Scheme is below Lisp at 45. Closure is at number 42. These absolutely are like Lisps, and I wonder whether they would get better results by combining those languages. I'm sure that this is something that like people complain about their methodology all the time, and probably to them as well. So I'm, yeah, let's just leave it as an open question. I don't actually care enough about the specifics of where languages sit in this thing. It was just an interesting like observation. So Lisp at number 34, 0.32% of their sort of search-based popularity methodology. Okay, let's say that, you know, I decide that Lisp is a really interesting CV-friendly language. It's probably actually one of the best ones to choose, actually, because it is a mature and stable language. But, you know, it's almost a programming language that's older than computers. It's certainly older than computers that could run it effectively. And so, like, it has a longevity, like, the the three maintainers aren't going to get bored and give up and go and get jobs at Netflix in the next 6 months. You know, there will be Lisp for the rest of time. But it might not be that easy to find Lisp developers in your area who want to work in your problem domain on your project. On the other hand, it may be that people who are inside the company already, once they get started with this Lisp thing, go, actually, I'm painting my career into a corner here because I'm not going to find it easy to change jobs if I wait. This is particularly true of like in-house languages, you know, sort of bespoke languages, which are done for various reasons. I used to work at an antivirus company, and we had the detection engine was it was written in C, very cross-platform code, and very ancient cross-platform code as well. You know, it could cope with like ints being 16 bits or 64 bits because like on Itanium with LPI 64 they were 64 bits, and on MS-DOS they were 16 bits. You know, this is how broad the platform support of this thing was. But what it did was it exposed a stack-based programming language that was based on some Hewlett-Packard programmable calculator language, because that was what the one person who had written the detection engine at the time that they wrote the detection engine, you know, when it was like a five-person company, that was what they thought they could use for detecting viruses. But now, like, if you're an analyst working on you know, in their labs, in their malware labs, on building detection for malware, you basically can't use that experience as programming experience that transfers to any other project, because like, you know, the whole paradigm is something akin to PostScript or Forth, which nobody else is using, and nobody's definitely going to like employ you for your use of that in-house language. And people are bad enough at employing programmers not to really understand how to evaluate transferable programming skills, so they're going to want to see you, you know, reverse a linked list in their language. So you may not only find it hard to hire from outside, you may find it hard to retain on the inside as well. Basically, introducing programming languages is problematic. Now, I've even made the mistake where I have picked like popular languages which are well suited to the domain of the problem that I'm working on, but because there was no expertise within my team, it still caused maintenance and support problems. And like, I'm talking within the last couple of years. Yeah, so these are all like top 10, top 20 languages. You know, I had a web application. I needed to very quickly, due to a short deadline for an initial release, I needed to very quickly get from zero to functioning project. And so I chose Ruby on Rails because I'm not particularly familiar with Ruby on Rails, but I know enough about it to know that I could, you know, use a lot of its scaffolding, a lot of Active Record and other parts of Rails to very quickly get to a working project. I could just like dump out my brain fart of what I thought the problem domain looked like in an object-oriented sense, connect that all up to a web app and have a running thing. And indeed I did. But then the people who were going to take it on after me, you know, when we got to that first deadline, we realized that I would have to move on to a different project, and the other people on the team who were going to take this on didn't understand Ruby and didn't understand Rails. So now, well, I've got a problem. I've used a very popular programming language, and yet I have done it in a way that precludes other people from working on the project. That's not my only rodeo there. Another one, a similar situation, I used PHP, but that was because the existing project was in PHP. Nobody else on my team knew PHP. Luckily, like once I delivered the finished product, like the people who had commissioned us were happy to sort of take it on. So that one actually succeeded, but only because of luck. It could have run into the same problem. The third one was one where I picked the implementation language because of what I knew about the customer. They were a team who had a desktop app built in Windows Forms with C Sharp. And they asked me to do the companion mobile app, so I went, okay, I will learn enough C Sharp to do this with Xamarin Forms. And that slowed me down. I had to learn like MVVM, I had to learn C Sharp, I had to learn Xamarin, I had to learn how you bridge Xamarin to iOS and Android so I could write the sort of platform specific renderer parts of this project. I had to understand how Visual Studio works with like solutions and projects and NuGet and all this kind of stuff. So C Sharp is like definitely not an esoteric language. Let me just have a look on the old popularity index here. It's top 20. It's number 5. You know, it's the 5th most popular programming language according to this methodology. But nobody else on my team knows C Sharp. I had limited time allotted to this project, and nobody on the client side wanted to adopt the code, even though I had like picked the implementation choices such that it was easy for them to adopt. So this extra piece of information that the client didn't expect to support this thing themselves, which I didn't realize at the sort of inception of the project. And you know, you may be against big design up front, but there are some things that you need to know at the beginning. This was one of them that I didn't know until the end of the project, where they started complaining that I was no longer available. This caused like serious problems because they wouldn't work on the project. I couldn't work on the project, and none of my team could work on the project either because I'd used a language that they weren't familiar with, even though I had picked, like, you know, in scare quotes, the best tool for the job based on, you know, a number of reasonable factors. It still turned out not to be the best tool for the job. So, like, I think you have to be really very, very conservative at choosing an implementation language for a we need the product project. You need to be very good at saying, while it would be interesting to do it in this, the safest thing to do it in is, and there are still a bunch of options there. So, you know, if it's a desktop application, you've got a choice of a number of native sort of programming languages. You've got a number of cross-platform tools which enable other programming languages. You've got the choice of doing basically a web application in a wrapper, if that turns out to be appropriate. And then you can split the scare quotes back end from front end, and you've still got a large number of choices, all of which would be better than, you know, some esoteric thing that suits your needs. But you have to consider, even if this is a popular language, what is it, you know, where does its popularity intersect with the population that are going to have to deal with this project? My third example of where we're monetizing the hobby, of where we're putting our own interests over the interests of the success of the shared endeavor, of the, you know, collective operation on which we're working, is introducing a load of cloud shit which costs more than it helps. Now, examples of when you're doing this are, if you have no customers, then you don't need any resilience yet. Like, what you need to do is to demonstrate to somebody that there is something worth paying for. And then you need to deploy it at the times that that person is awake. That's like, you know, that's 3 threes of uptime. It's not 3 nines of uptime. If you have a handful of customers, you probably only need one server. And if you have many customers, You need to do whatever is keeping the balls in the air at a sort of satisfactory level. And that still might not be reaching straight for Netflix's technology stack. You know, where many customers in, say, automated financial planning is hundreds or thousands of people, again, who work for like 8 hours a day, not millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people worldwide expecting, like, you know, always on access. There's a massive difference between those things. And also, by the time you get up to like the big, really big scales, you know, the Google scale, Facebook scale, even Apple for that matter, you start bringing all this stuff in again because you're paying for it. Paying to rent it costs way more than just buying the hardware and like continually adding it to your data center does at that scale. So at the small scale, a single server is going to give you an understood amount of capacity that is going to be like somewhat reliable and pretty cheap when amortized over the cost of the, you know, amortized over the lifetime of when you bought it to when you eventually outgrow it. At the big scale, like, you know, you're basically paying someone else to run your data center and take a profit from you when it would be cheaper just to like run the data center. And in the middle, there is this realm where, yes, you may get some benefit either in terms of improved capability or in terms of cost savings from you know, from outsourcing your infrastructure, but you've got to treat it as an outsourced decision. As I keep coming back to, buy versus build is the most important question an engineering organization can ask, and you need to look at your infrastructure choices as buy versus build choices, not as wouldn't it be cool to integrate this feature that Amazon just introduced choices. That's not an appropriate way to like run an engineering department. Let me give you an example of when you don't need a cloud service and when you don't need the latest in elastic self-healing auto-scaling infrastructure. I used to work on a platform that had quite a few Objective-C, what would now be called microservices and back then were called processes, which communicated with distributed objects and a shared Postgres database. And that supported millions of customers at the same time. You know, we would have predictable usage spikes where we'd have sort of thousands of customers for a lot of or thousands of people using this thing via like mobile for most of the day. And then predictable times when it would go up to millions of people trying to use it over a short window of time. And that sat on about a third of a rack of Dell hardware. And we had, I think, four copies of it. One in a data center in London, one in a data center in Birmingham, a third in a data center in South Africa, because the internet connection to South Africa from the rest of the world was really bad at the time. And so it was much better to support people with a local copy of the stack than it was to like, you know, to try and get them to use it over the internet to the London copy of the stack. And the fourth one was another copy in the office in London, which had two purposes. One was that I could run performance tests on equivalent hardware to the production instance, and the other was it had blinky lights, which made us look like we knew what we were doing when sort of, you know, customers and partners came to visit. So in total, we had the reason we had two copies in the UK was we had one customer who was big enough to need their own copy. It wasn't that we needed a redundant thing, because like the entire thing was redundant, and so you know, that third of a stack had a massively redundant RAID collection. It had for the database, it had like two database servers, multiple application servers, and you know, so the only single point of failure was if either the data center got destroyed, at which point we were all too busy applying for new jobs to care about whether we could bring the rack back up, or if the top of rack switch failed. And we looked at how reliable these top of rack switches were supposed to be and decided to live with that. So, you know, the entire thing was effectively on like the equivalent of one rack of hardware, and supported millions of people. You don't need to reach straight for whatever it is that someone wants to sell you as a cloud service. Now, the reason I'm talking about this problem of monetizing the hobby, is that there are already many problems that teams have balancing the needs of and expectations of their customer, their client, you know, the person who is benefiting from their work, with what we call the caring and feeding of the computer. You know, things like, when can we schedule maintenance? Like, when can we apply security updates? How can we balance, like, getting the updates out in a timely fashion with keeping the system up when people need to use it? When can we schedule time for cleaning up the gnarly areas of the code? And I've made the point before that there's a difference between technical debt and design mistakes, or poor choices. And like, both of these need to be worked on. The difference is that you theoretically plan for technical debt to be worked on. But when do you get time to do it? And like, when are you allowed to take away from the immediate satisfaction of customer expectations in order to do this other important work? Dealing with curveballs thrown by the technology vendors or the suppliers, you know, a new version of open source framework comes out and they've decided that they're no longer going to do security updates to the old version, and they've completely changed the API. Well, who and how are you going to cope with that? Or you're using some like proprietary application framework and they arbitrarily decide that the way that you detect and respond to the device rotating is going to change in two subsequent major versions of the platform, and you now need to support all three of the ways in which rotation can be detected. Well, you've got to add those other two ways you know, on your team, and that is something that your customer thinks already works. And how do you sort of, you know, schedule that into your development? Yeah, you're already being kept busy enough doing all of the work that it takes to just get to the output that somebody wants. It is much, much harder to do that if you also add a bunch of work that nobody else values, for various meanings of the word value. You know, I'm not just talking about like someone paying for this. I'm talking about, you know, maybe it's a medical thing. You're going to save lives. Are you going, like, at what point do you say, actually, I'm just going to put off the life-saving nature of this project for a bit because I've always wanted to integrate Kotlin into a project and I think that now is the time. Or, you know, I've worked with a number of, like, non-profit organisations, like unions. Do you say, okay, we're not going to, like, fight these redundancies for the moment because it would be really cool if I could try out this new framework and spend 2 weeks rewriting this feature of your code? You know, those are the kinds of decisions that you're actually making. If you think about not what the value is in terms of who is paying for your work, but what the value is in terms of what the people are doing with it. And like, that's even true in what you might think of as some sort of skeevy or sketchy or you know, just sort of amoral organizations like financial technology. Like, let's say you go, okay, I really, really want to like use Mongo, even though it's an entirely inappropriate database and will take us ages to recover back to some sort of usable level of performance, but I'm going to do it anyway. And it's only a bunch of financial planners, except that those financial planners, they're helping people plan their retirement. So it's, you know, it's the difference between someone being able to like stop work and enjoy the fruits of their labor, and someone having to continue working because they got, you know, poor financial advice and can't afford to retire. Like, that's the kind of value that I'm talking about, not the is someone going to pay to monetize my hobby. Now, fundamentally, when it comes down to like our choice of tools or our choice of fancy programming language features or whatever, like, there is no objective basis for evaluating these. We've never stood still for long enough to do any form of reasonable like cross evaluation. You can get very, very limited benchmarks that tell you information, whether that information is helpful or not. Like, if some people will say, well, the compile time's better on this tool than that tool, therefore you get to a solution faster. Okay, but if I use Perl 5, I don't compile at all. I get to a solution way faster, and yet for some reason we've all rejected Perl 5. Oh, well, Perl 5 has a ton of different features and syntax that make it really hard to use. Swift has got a ton of syntax and features that don't particularly glue together all that well, and yet plenty of people find it plenty easy to use. You know, it's taught to kids via the Swift Playgrounds app as a sort of get children into coding activity. Smalltalk, for that matter, was like written as an educational tool for children, although Alan Kay accepts that by the time it got to Smalltalk 80, nobody was like actually doing that, and it probably couldn't be done. So, you know, who told you that you would get to a solution faster if you changed from this language to that language? Was it the language vendor? Was it an advocate who works for a company who sell like adjunct tools in this space? Was it some random blogger on Substack? Was it a bald man on the internet who got access to a microphone? Because really, that's what all of software engineering, you know, expertise and leadership comes down to, is people like me able to make compelling arguments for why you should try one thing or another. And, you know, once you get here, you kind of realise how cynical that is, and you try and stop people listening, really. That's basically been the point of this episode, is to say, when someone tells you how much, you know, better their tool is, you need to ask, you need to challenge them, you need to say, well, better at what, better for whom, is my project genuinely going to benefit from the adoption of this tool, and in what way will it benefit? Will it be a better activity, or will I get a better outcome? And which is important on this project? As ever, if you'd like to support this work of, you know, just being very angry and cynical at you over the internet, please go to patreon.com/IamLeeG. If you'd like to get in contact, maybe to stop me from being so cynical over the internet at you, you can email grahamlee@acm.org, or you can find me on Twitter, iwasleeg. Thank you for getting to the end of this podcast, assuming you just didn't skip the bit in the middle, which, you know, you're entirely entitled to do. It is your own choice, and you may be here for the outcome rather than for the journey, in which case I say thank you very much, and I will talk to you again next time.